Okay, so my roommate Paul and I, we just moved to a house in Detroit, Michigan. Now, Paul, there's lots to be said about Paul, but for now, I'm just going to mark that he's an accomplished, fairly good-looking white guy. He's intense. He's always thinking these thoughts like, the Constitution only applies to the first 13 states. Or, 95% of the universe is dark matter, and nobody knows what the rest of it's made of. That's just the way he is. And because Paul's interested in everything, it surprises me not in the least when I arrive home one day to find him watching a TV show featuring Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. What Paul finds personally appealing about Farrakhan's message of black empowerment, I do not know. But then it's Paul. And Paul is really digging on this show. He's clapping and cheering. That's right, Louis, that's right. Then I hear the shouting. I run out. What's the problem? Farrakhan just said that black women shouldn't date white dudes. He said it's an abomination. Calm down. People say stuff on TV. But what if I want to talk to one of these sisters? Brother, it's your lucky day. We live in Detroit. There's plenty to choose from, and Farrakhan doesn't run this. Well, I see him. He's fuming, right? Whatever. I figure in a few days, he'll forget all about it. But he doesn't forget. He keeps talking about how Louis Farrakhan let him down. How it's not right that the Nation of Islam, the Detroit chapter founded by one Malcolm X, isn't cool with equal opportunity getting down. Paul, it does not matter. It doesn't matter. He will not listen. And one day, we're driving down the street about to pick up some barbecue when we see 8 or 9 Nation of Islam fellas. They're clean shaven, pressed suit, bow tied, no nonsense, serious about their business brothers walking down the street. And Paul pulls over the car. And he's like, I'm gonna go talk to him about this thing with black women. And this right here, this here is where I put my foot down. Are you crazy? That's the fruit. You don't go messing with the fruit. What's wrong with you? Huh? What's the fruit? The fruit of Islam are the paramilitary arm of the Nation of Islam. The brothers that don't play. Black nationalists are scared of them. Let it go, Paul. I'm just gonna go talk to him. Don't do it, Paul. Let it go. Paul opens the door, strolls over to the fellas. And it's the end of the line time for my man Paul. I lean way down in the car so no one mistakes me as being with this crazy person, and I wait for the unfortunate tragedy to unfold. It shouldn't take long. I ease my head up to window level, only to see Paul hanging with the fruit of Islam. Everybody joking and laughing. He's like, all right, later on, fellas. He gets back in the car, all smiles. What'd they say? I convinced them. You convinced them? Yep. He pulls out in the traffic. He pauses. Then he looks at me serious. Yeah, but we should probably lay off the pork. Today, on Snap Judgment, we proudly present The End of the Line. Amazing stories from real people pushing past their own point of no return. My name is Glenn Washington. Please make sure your emergency information is in order. Because this is Snap Judgment. Now you know all the sayings. Darkest before the dawn, calm before the storm. When the chips are down, what matters when you're facing the end of your line, you want to have a friend. Snap Judgment's Nancy Lopez spoke to Vicky Croak. Vicky's a reporter with WBUR in Boston, and she recently wrote about a special bond, and she's going to help us tell this next story. Snap Judgment.
It's 1942, and World War II has come to Burma. British forces are scrambling to fight off the Japanese, and to do so, they enlist the help of a teak logger who knows the jungles of Western Burma like the back of his hand, a man by the name of Bill Williams.
He's a real hero, and to me, not necessarily because he fought in World War II, but because of the way that he thought about animals, which was pretty unusual for the time.
Bill loves his elephants. He's been working side by side with them in the logging camps, breaking down teak trees for the past 2 decades. And to him, they're like his family.
Bill knew 1,000 elephants by name in Burma. He had a wide network of elephant handlers, and he went to his superiors and said, "Look, I've provided you a lot of information, but what I really can do is gather up my elephants on the other side." By now, the Japanese had really taken over Burma. There was a strip of land, a lot of it where Bill used to do his logging work, and he wanted to get just over the border and try to bring back his elephants so they could work for the Allied forces.
But no one is listening to Bill until one day when an officer says to him, "Hey, I need to build a bridge."
And he provided Bill with very fancy blueprints for a very fancy bridge. And Bill took one look at them and said, "You don't want me to make this. You want me to make an elephant bridge." He explained what an elephant bridge was, which was these very simple structures where logs were pulled in close to one another by elephants who could not only pull the logs down from the forest, but like cranes, they could heft them up, and they knew enough on their own, they didn't even have to be told, they could squeeze the logs in one by one next to each other until they fit into a bridge. And the officer said, "Well, I need a bridge that can support two-way traffic." And Bill said to him, "Well, an elephant bridge can't do that, but I could build 2 elephant bridges side by side that would." The officer gave him the green light.
Immediately, Bill sets out to recruit as many of his handlers and elephants as he can. This is dangerous work. With the Japanese in control, British pilots are forced to drop Bill down behind enemy lines. As he infiltrates through the forest, he does manage to reach many of his elephant handlers, convincing them to join him.
And they trusted him, and they were loyal to him. And despite the fact that what they were about to do was punishable by death, they took their elephants through the forest and brought them back to Bill, one by one. He pointed out that it was actually easier to sneak elephants under the noses of the Japanese than it would be jeeps, because the elephants didn't require headlights and their motors didn't run and they didn't run out of gas.
And in a matter of months, Bill forms Elephant Company, his very own brigade of working elephants. And the troops, they begin calling him Elephant Bill.
As soon as any of the soldiers or officers in one area saw an elephant bridge go up in a heartbeat and be so reliable, everybody wanted them.
Bill has over 1,600 elephants in Elephant Company. But the one that matters most to him is a very special one by the name of Bandula. Standing more than 9 feet high, which is pretty tall for an Asian elephant, with lavender skin, pink freckles across his cheeks, and tusks that curl up like the arms of a Burmese dancer, Bandula is Bill's favorite elephant.
In my mind, they were like twins. One was a man and one was an elephant. But I think of them both as being enormously courageous and strong and having a sense of humor. And they seem to feel it in one another.
Bill and Bandula are actually the same age, born in the same year and on the same month. When they first met more than 20 years back, Bill was immediately in awe of this magnificent creature.
But the most remarkable thing happened, and that is that when Bill Williams walked up to Bandula, he pressed his palm against Bandula's skin, and he swore that something magical happened between them in that moment. He knew Bandula would understand him in a way that most human beings never would.
Bill calls Bandula his number one war elephant. He was actually the first one inducted into Elephant Company.
There was confidence for the first time, and he had established elephant camp, and things were going well for him, but the Japanese were moving more quickly than anyone anticipated. there was suddenly chaos in the area where Bill was. And one day when he was in camp, he received a secret code on his field phone that he was to remove all of the elephants that he had in the area, as many elephants as he could, and bring them to the safety of India. No one thought he would make it, not even the officers above him, one of whom said to Bill, "Even if I had the chance to leave the war zone and come with you, I'd rather stay here and starve." That's the extent to which no one around him thought that he could make it. But he had no choice. He knew that if he stayed behind, his elephants would be killed.
Bill has to get out now. He's only able to gather his best elephants, including Bandula. And just when he thinks his caravan of people and elephants can't get any bigger, a group of refugees are dropped in his lap.
He already had a tough mission ahead of him, and bringing these 64 women and children with him, he knew would hamstring the effort, but he couldn't imagine saying no and leaving them there. So in April, Elephant Bill gathered his handlers, the soldiers, the refugees, the elephants he had at hand. So this was nearly 200 people and 53 elephants. That's 45 adult elephants and 8 babies. He loaded them up with 15 days supply. That's what he figured it would take to march 120 miles from the battlefield over 5 razorback mountain ranges to the safety of India. He knew every mile would be hell.
Bill has a primitive map, and he draws a straight line from where he is straight over the mountains to India, and off they go.
And they had to slash their way through very dense vegetation. They could hear enemy fire. They knew the enemy was around every day of their trip. They were afraid of being ambushed, and with good reason. On day 9, Bill went ahead, as he often did, to scout a new location. He was out ahead. He found himself in a very lush area with a creek, which was good news for feeding the elephants and for getting them water.
But his sense of relief only lasts a second.
And he came to a sheer cliff face, 270 feet high. It was like walking straight into a wall. He looked to the north and he looked to the south. It didn't look like this, that the escarpment ended. And his heart just sank. There's no way he could go back. The Japanese were well known for torturing, bayoneting, raping the women. His group of human beings couldn't go back to face the enemy, and he didn't want his elephants to face them either. He came back to the creek to meet his party, to tell the officers what he had found. He filled them in, and they decided they would camp in this kind of lush green bowl. And in the morning, they would have 3 parties who would scout out whether there was an end to this escarpment or a way up and over it. By the end of that day, everyone returned to camp to say that there wasn't any way over it and there wasn't any way around it. They just went back to that area, dumbstruck, looking at the sheer cliff face. What were they going to do? I mean, it was as grim as it could possibly be. And in that moment, they all noticed that there was a ledge high up. And below that ledge, there were some outcrops of rocks. When they looked more closely, they saw some rocks jutting out. And so a crazy thought begins to enter their minds. They wondered, this is porous sandstone. Like, could we possibly cut the rock ourselves? Could we make more footfalls? Could we make something like steps? And then they thought, I mean, even if they made it for the people, what would you do about the elephants? And someone said, or they all thought, could we cut an elephant stairway? Could we cut steps that the elephants could actually climb up? And even as they thought that, they knew how impossible it was. Even if they cut those steps, even if they were able to make real stairs, there were some really dangerous points where the best they could do would be to make something like a ladder. And everyone knows that elephants can't climb up ladders. Bill had spent a lifetime trusting elephants and being amazed by them, but even he thought, I can't even imagine how they would be persuaded to start, I can't imagine how they could negotiate something. Are they nimble enough to do that? What if another elephant looks down, loses her step, and falls? She would wipe out everyone underneath her. He could so easily imagine the horrifying result of even trying this.
Bill looks back at his elephants. In a river crossing, it's always up to the elephants to decide who leads. It's usually a female, and the process can take hours. But they don't have that kind of time here. Bill consults with his good friend Potok, who's a master elephant handler. And they both agree that if anyone can pull this off, it's Bandula.
Now, Bandula obviously wasn't a female, but in this case where the men had to make a decision, he felt that Bandula was a rare male, that the other elephants would follow his lead. So they decide, not that they thought it would actually all work, but they had no choice. They had to make something, they had to make whatever they could of that cliff, make it passable. And they spent a long day hacking away not only at vegetation, but rock itself. And by the end of that day, by sunset, there was kind of a miracle. I mean, here was this rough, zigzagging staircase straight up the cliff face. It was too narrow and too vertical in places, but they figured they'd take one more day and see if they could improve on it again and make it passable. And so they did, and they had before them what they knew, even if it didn't work, was their best shot at getting out.
And now all they can do is hope that tomorrow the elephants will do their part. The plan is this. Bill will go up the stairway first. Bandula and Potok will go next. Then the other elephants will start. Women and children will follow. And there's to be absolutely no talking.
So the next morning, Bill often scouted ahead of the party. And he did this day, less because they needed someone to find the route for them, but because he felt he and Bandula were so close, he felt that they could read each other's minds. And on this day, when Bill had anything but confidence, he didn't want Bandula to see what was inside his head. Bill went ahead on his own, and he climbed halfway up the cliff face. He settled in on one of those outcroppings and waited. He could hear the creek below, and he could hear distant thuds of gunfire, as if he needed a reminder of what was at stake here. The enemy, the war, was catching up to them. And below the elephants, all 53 of them in a line, adults and babies, along with the people, arrived at the bottom. This is where Potok led Bandula. He led him to the base, and he showed him that first step, and he said to him in Burmese, Thwar, which means climb. Bandula was chosen because they thought he had the courage and the intelligence to know what was being asked of him. When Potok told him, climb, Bandula immediately put his front feet and then his back feet up. But then he stopped.
Bandula stands on that first makeshift step for 1 full minute. And then 2 minutes. 3 minutes pass. And then 9 minutes.
Everyone's fate was riding on what Bandula was about to do. No one knew then what Bandula was thinking. What was he mulling over or considering? While everyone behind him quaked in anticipation, was he going to do it or not? Halfway up the cliff, Bill didn't know what was going on. He didn't dare look down because of his own vertigo. But he couldn't hear the voices, and he had no idea whether Bandula had started or not. Bandula's just hovering on that first step, not going forward and not going back. And if Bandula didn't go, no elephant would go. Finally, he moved forward. And once he moved forward, he just climbed steadily, up and up. Bill sitting up on this perch, halfway up this 270-foot sheer cliff, and he's looking out over a valley, and suddenly his view is darkened by the beautiful, huge head of Bandula and his tusks as he made it up. Bill was really excited and really happy, but he didn't dare say anything. What he did as Bandula came up, He just moved himself. He scrambled on ahead of the elephant. I cannot even imagine what it was like to view for the people standing below. And I would imagine that their hearts were in their throats as they saw each animal begin the ascent and move up. And they had to have been scared out of their minds every moment that it took the elephants to move up there. It would take Bandula and then each elephant after him 3 hours to make it to the top. When Bandula made it to the top and Bill was waiting for him, he couldn't even put into words the way that he felt. Not only have the elephants done something that people never would have thought possible, but the fact that they made it to the top meant that everyone was going to live, that they had a chance to get out of this war zone and make it to safety. So for Bill, the elephant that he loved the most, that he thought of as a brother, shared that moment with him, led the way, brought all of the other elephants up. And for him, satisfaction isn't even the word. The deep emotion that Bill felt, that these animals that he loved so dearly that he would say that elephants weren't just his friends, they were his religion. And people always thought he was exaggerating about how intelligent they were, how trustworthy, how courageous. And in this moment, they proved everything he believed to be true.
A big thank you to Vicky Croak for helping us tell this story. To learn more about Bill and Bandula and the rest of the elephants, pick up a copy of Vicky's book, Elephant Company, and check out her website, VickyCroak.com. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece is produced by Nancy Lopez with sound design by Leon Morimoto. When Snap Judgment returns, we try to make some new friends in the desert. And planes, when you're flying, they're exactly where you want to be. When Snap Judgment, the end of the line episode, continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the end of the line episode. Stories about what to do when there's nothing left to do. And our next piece takes place in southwestern United States, where some guys give up on their silly little ideas, and other guys, not so much.
Okay. So this story starts out back in the mid-90s in Phoenix, where Godfrey Daniels...
My given name is Godfrey Daniels, but I go by Doc.
He's heading back home after seeing this band, Girl Trouble. And after the concert, someone hands him a copy of their zine. Remember zines? If not, don't worry. They're kind of like a pre-internet miniature magazine.
So as I was walking home, I was kind of flipping through it, and on about the third or fourth page, there were a couple of letters to the editor, and one of them mentioned that there was a phone booth in the Mojave Desert, miles and miles from any pavement, just sitting by itself.
And this, for Doc, just made no sense.
I wasn't sure that I believed it.
Why not?
Well, I didn't have any reason to believe it. I mean, I don't know if in the age of cell phones, if it's the same, but when you were out in the desert in those days, you were on your own. You couldn't call people. So the idea that there could be this phone booth just sitting out in an uncontactable place. It was kind of like if somebody was on the moon, you know, and you could talk to somebody on the moon.
Where did he say it was exactly? And like, what was the nearest recognizable landmark?
He didn't say. It was a really short little paragraph. There wasn't any solid information, really, other than the number.
And so when Doc got home, he thought, okay, why not give it a shot?
And I jabbed in the number, and it just rang. And I let it ring for a long time. And I was just imagining making a phone ring out where, presumably, no one could hear it except the coyotes. But then there was also in the back of your mind the thought, what if? Like, what if somebody's wandering by? Who would be out there? Who would pick up? It just really grabbed me. And so I hung up, and then I just kept thinking about it. I kept thinking about it all night long. I was thinking about it as I fell asleep, and it just somehow got me into its clutches.
And so the next morning?
I called again. I just kind of became obsessed.
Soon, Doc found himself calling the phone booth all the time. When friends visited his house, he'd twist their arm and make them call it. He even put up a post-it note in the bathroom mirror.
It just said, "Did you remember to call the Mojave Desert today?" But it turned out I didn't need it because I used to call many times a day.
Like how many times?
If I was supposed to be working, I was probably calling at least once an hour. And again, this is all assuming that it actually existed, which I had no proof of.
Like on speakerphone? Or like you would stop everything?
No, because that would require explanations. I would just, you know, have the phone kind of cradled against my ear, you know, just listening to it ring.
Doc knew it was weird to keep calling a number with no one on the other end. But if he was ever pressed about it, he'd say it was like being a ham radio operator. One little person sending a signal as far as he could into the ether, wondering if another little person was out there, listening in, waiting to be contacted in that uncontactable place.
So I figured I would be doing this forever. I really didn't think anybody would ever pick up the phone.
But then, just 1 month after he started calling?
Just doing my daily call, and I got a busy signal.
No way!
So Doc actually managed to record that call.
I look like I'm an idiot, because I keep saying, wow.
No way.
And I thought, well, I must have misdialed.
I had to dial it.
So I dialed it again. And it was a busy signal again. I realized, okay, either something's gone wrong with the phone company here, or somebody is using the Mojave phone booth right now. I was totally hyperactive. My main thing was I didn't want them to get away. Like, I was thinking, I need to catch it right when they hang up that phone. So I just redial, and then it rang. And it rang 4 or 5 times, and I thought, oh, crap. And then I heard a voice say, hello.
Sadly, Doc was only able to properly record his own words at this now historic moment.
But as many times as I had called, I had given remarkably little thought, if any, to what I would say, you know. And I said,
hello, are you in the Mojave Desert?
She said, yeah. And I said,
you are? Okay, this is going to sound like a strange question. Why are you in the middle of the Mojave Desert?
She said, I'm making my calls.
Oh, like you live out there, and you don't have a phone.
I got to say, when I looked at the transcript, it was kind of funny, because, like, you think everything's cool if you're like...
So what do you do out there?
And she's like, cinder mining?
What do you do with cinder?
And she's like, cinder blocks. and you're like, that's so cool.
That is so cool. That's just so cool that somebody finally answered.
And, she said that she never heard the phone ring before.
Can you tell me her name?
Yeah, her name's Laureen.
Laureen, it's nice to meet you. If the phone's ever ringing again, pick it up. It'll be me. All right, nice meeting you. Bye-bye.
Was there any sense of disappointment?
No. Disappointment about what? Not at all.
Well, let me put it this way. It's almost kind of like... the idea that this phone is ringing out there in the desert and anyone mm-hmm. could pick up. But then finally someone picks up and it's just Laureen.
No. See, I look at it the exact opposite way. Somebody did pick up and I had no right to expect anyone ever would. So this was great to hear a human voice in place of the ringing, you know? I mean, this was a payoff. It just encouraged me more. And the instant I hung up, I kicked myself because I had forgotten to ask her what was probably the most important question, which is where was the phone booth? But of course, I had no way to get in touch with her except to find the thing.
So Doc calls around, does some sleuthing, and a few months later gets his hands on the equivalent of an X Marks the Spot map showing the supposed location of the Mojave phone booth.
I thought, oh, we're all set. So my friend and I took off and traveled all day to the Mojave Desert. And this is in the middle of August, and so it's scorching hot, just scorching hot. Basically, as far as you could see, you saw Joshua trees. And then we saw this little dirt path that was marked, you know, danger, danger, warning, not maintained, blah, blah, blah. That was the road we were supposed to take. So we were just going along. And at first I thought, oh, this is not bad at all. But the further along that we went, the road would narrow. And the thing was that the sun was going down. And in the daytime, you've got these grand, huge vistas, and you kind of have a sense of where you are. But when the darkness drops, it's just whatever you can see right in front of you. And we were ringed by storms. There was lightning almost in every direction. So then I started to think, if we have any kind of a problem, unless we do find the phone booth, we have no way of, you know, letting people know we're really in trouble. But at a certain point, just barely in the reach of the headlights, I thought I saw a line of telephone poles. And there was a little jut to the left, and then a little jut to the right. And I brought the van to a stop with the headlights just shining right on the Mojave phone booth. It was really quite a moment. And there's bullet holes in it. There's no glass. It's all busted out. It's kind of a wreck, you know? But to me, it was beautiful. I needed to hear that phone ring. I needed to hear what I had been causing to happen all this time out there. So I called my friend's pager, and here I am out in the Mojave surrounded by Joshua trees and lightning and desert. And now there's a familiar ping. It was so loud. It was really loud. The bell was just crazy loud. For me, that was kind of the moment, is hearing that phone ring. It was everything that I had been imagining when I was calling.
After that, Doc thought the story was over. He did keep calling the booth. After all, someone else could pick up. But that was just for him. He never really expected anyone else to care. Until he did something which would not have seemed risky back in 1997, but which today is obviously very, very dangerous. He gave the booth a webpage.
And in those days, the internet, there wasn't that much on it. So I thought that was about as far as it would go.
But yeah, that's not what happened.
Next thing you know, I'd go to my P.O. box and there would be clippings about the Mojave phone booth from newspapers in languages that I didn't read. It just spread. So I thought, well, this is unexpected.
And so when Doc and his friends returned to the booth about a year after his initial visit, when they got there, this phone, way out in the middle of nowhere, which Lorene had said she'd never heard ring, it was ringing off the hook.
You didn't have to call anybody. It was just, as soon as you would hang up the phone, it would start ringing again. It was just crazy. You'd pick it up and, you know, who's this person going to be? Where are they going to be? And you had no idea. It could be somebody from, you know, Vietnam or Iran or just anywhere. Some people would call and you couldn't talk to them because they didn't speak English. And again, you know, most of the time, it wasn't about the content. You know, you're not really saying anything. It's really not the point. It's just the connection. An old trucker guy called, and I think he just wanted to be listened to. He wanted to tell stories about his trucking days, and he didn't seem to have anybody to tell him to.
How many calls did you end up taking that day?
It would be over 100, guaranteed. And admittedly, you hear the phone ring, and after a while, it'd be like, you get it. No, you get it. It's your turn. You get it. We eventually had to take it off the hook so we could sleep.
And when they put it back on the hook the next morning so they could leave?
There wouldn't have been a way to leave in silence. I mean, you were going to have to drive. Since it was ringing all the time, you were going to have to drive away from a ringing phone.
And people weren't just calling the booth.
Mojave Desert phone booth.
They were visiting, traveling all the way out to the desert, just for the honor of informing callers that, yes, the phone booth was real.
It's more than real. It's reality.
This is from a short documentary made about the booth. It's just a montage of people from all over the place, taking calls from all over the place.
We're here. Where are you?
England?
We're from Switzerland.
Australia.
Right on, bro.
You were presenting yourself to the world in a way. Anybody who wanted to could call you. There was no control over who could call that phone.
No. No, I don't speak German.
You used to work for the circuit?
So are you quadriplegic or paraplegic? Quad?
Wait a minute. You got fired from the circus because your best friend slept with somebody else.
How long were you in a coma?
A couple weeks.
Yeah, me too. I was in a coma for 2 weeks.
It's kind of fun. You should come out and do this.
We're pretty lonely out here.
Did you like the fact that it became popular, or would you have preferred it to remain?
No, at first I liked it. The hesitation came about just because once something like that gets out of control, then you know that the equal and opposite reaction is going to come. The only question was when. And then in May of 2000, Lorene's brother, on the way out to the mine, stopped and answered the phone, because it was ringing, of course, and talked to some guy in England who was, he said he was sitting there with his fiance eating, having tea and crumpets. And he talked to him for a little while and then continued on to Lorene's. And then in the morning when they were leaving, the booth was gone.
In this case, the equal and opposite reaction had come in the form of the National Park Service. It turned out the booth was almost smack dab in the center of a new national preserve. When the phone had laid dormant, it hadn't been a problem. But park officials hadn't taken kindly to all the new foot traffic, or for that matter, the ringing. By the time Doc figured out what was happening, it was already too late. Did you go out and see this for yourself?
No. I didn't go out until, I think, about 2009, 2010, long after. I mean, once I knew it was gone, I didn't want to go out.
Why not?
Just be too sad, you know? I mean, had a lot of fun there. it was funny, too, is that people did keep going out, and they would go and visit the concrete pad that the booth had stood on, and a guy made a really nice tombstone for the booth, and everything that anybody brought out there, the Park Service hauled off, and eventually they came out and broke up the concrete pad and took that away, too.
So it was like it was never there?
Yeah. When I was there, the only thing left was a few pieces of glass from the broken windows. And people would say, yeah, well, it's not your phone booth. And I would say, yeah, I know, it's not my phone booth, but it's my fault. You know, it wasn't as though I set out to make a phone booth famous, far from it. It's just, had I known, I might not have done it. I mean, I might still, I don't know, but I might not have.
Would the booth even hold the same appeal today, given that we can now reach anyone, anywhere?
No, I mean, that's something that I have thought about is whether it could have happened even 5 years later. And I just don't think it would have. I mean, that was kind of the magic of being in contact in an uncontactable place. And I don't think you have that feeling now.
Did you ever try calling the number again after that?
Oh, of course. Come on, Joe. Of course I did. I mean, they let it ring for a long time. I mean, they left just even though the phone was not there.
But would that even make sense? Because you're not even making a phone ring anymore in the desert. You're just making a kind of a...
Well, sure, I would know that. But still, it would be like listening to a song that meant something to you. I don't know, just... I guess I did just like calling out to the booth and hearing it ring in the end.
Big thanks to Doc for sharing his story. You can still see the original Mojave phone booth webpage in all its glory at deuceofclubs.com. And stay on the lookout as well for Doc's upcoming book about all his adventures in the Mojave. Many thanks as well to Karina Cleverly Roberto and Derek Roberto for letting us share clips from their documentary short, Mojave Mirage. We'll have a link to both the website and the film at Snap Judgment. .org. Now, when Snap returns, it's all well and good to give your all for family and friends. But what about someone you don't even know? On Snap Judgment, the End of the Line episode continues. Stay tuned.
Support for Snap Judgment comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the end of the line episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today on the show, we're exploring what people do when they are all out of options. Our next story takes place at high speed, at high altitude, and with high drama.
Hi, I'm Shirley Dygert. I'm a mail carrier, rural mail carrier in Groesbeck, Texas. I am not the kind of person that would naturally be drawn to skydiving. I'm not one to take chances like that.
I'm David Hartsock. I think for myself, it's kind of like therapy almost, because when you're skydiving, you can't be thinking about, did I leave the oven on? Oh my gosh, I got that paperwork that I got to do for work.
My older son had gone skydiving on his 30th birthday. So when my younger son, 2 years later, decided to celebrate his 30th birthday the same way, he invited me along. At that time, I just looked over at my husband, and he's like, very wide-eyed, looking at me. You're really going to do this? I says, oh my gosh, yeah, let's do it.
It was obvious she was nervous about it, so I tried to make it as lighthearted as possible.
He just come walking straight up to me, looking right in my eye, and stuck his hand out there and introduced himself.
One of the things I always tell my students to try to calm their nerves is that we're connected up there. There's no way the person's going to get away from me. So I told her that you can be sure that nothing's going to happen to you because I'm going to make sure nothing happens to me.
And so we go taxiing off. We're like above the clouds. We're way up there. It looked like I was going to be doing this. Yeah.
We got to the door. I crossed our hands in front of her, tilted her head back against my shoulder, and rocked forward back in the plane, and out we go.
One, two, three. And we bailed out of the plane. We did a free fall for a while. You didn't feel like you were really falling. You felt like you were in a wind tunnel almost or something like that. It's just very windy. And it was beautiful. I couldn't hardly wait till the parachute would open, and then I could just really get a good view of everything.
I deployed the primary parachute, and you're expecting to go into a nice, smooth glide, and instead we got hit like a brick wall. The canopy was flapping very hard because half of it had not inflated.
We were going around so fast and so hard. We were like laying out flat. We were going around like that. It was just made me very dizzy.
I realized, well, I've got to cut this canopy away so it'll get away from us, and then I can deploy the reserve parachute. But the way the parachute had so violently opened, it had jerked the harness that she was in and the harness I was in, and the handle that should have been right accessible on the right side of my body had folded underneath the harness I was wearing.
And I could hear him grunting and trying hard. You could just hear him trying hard to reach something.
And so that's when she asked me if everything was okay. And I was honest with her and told her no, it was not okay, that we had a serious problem.
And it's like the world stopped. And all I could think about was my husband not really wanting me to go, and why did I push for this? What is happening? I can't believe this might happen.
I realized that we were in a very, very serious situation, and it was probably not going to end well.
I thought about my mom. I had just lost my mom not too long before that, and I thought about seeing my mom again and knew I was going to. And then when I thought about my mom, I thought about my kids. My kids and my grandkids, 3 grandchildren, and my husband and my other son were on the ground watching this. And I just said, God, I didn't want them to have to see this. I just knew this was my moment, that this was my last day on Earth.
Knowing that her 2 sons and her husband could see their mother and wife spinning into the ground thinking, oh my God, she's going to be dead. And I wasn't going to let that happen no matter what. At that point, you know, we were probably down to 3,000 feet, and I went ahead and deployed the reserve parachute, but unfortunately all it did was get tangled up into the main parachute. I was looking down at the ground to see where we were headed. It's a pretty much a farm area, so there's houses, barns, barbed wire fences, all kinds of things you can hit that it's going to kill you. I had a brief thought about, well, this is my fate. Oh well, you know, the primary thing now is to make sure that at least one of us survives, and that one person that needs to survive is the student. And I figured what I would do is swing my body underneath hers so that way she would land on me. The last 3 seconds, just as we were spinning in, I told her to raise her legs.
He said, "Get ready for a rough landing, Shirley." I was laying right smack on top of David. He was on his back on the ground. I was right on top of him. And I could hear him trying to breathe, like let out a hard breath. All I could think about is, oh my gosh, we got to help him get up. I didn't think about all that could be wrong with him. I just wanted him to get up.
When I woke up in the hospital, I think the first time that I can actually remember waking up, my mom was right there by my bedside, and because of the collapsed lungs, they had to do a tracheotomy, so I had a trach in my throat, so I couldn't speak, I couldn't move any of my limbs, but my mom was there, and she told me I was a quadriplegic. Yeah, I'd broken the bone in my neck, and that I was paralyzed from the chest down. I was thinking, well, that ain't so bad, you know, I'm still alive, which, you know, surprised the hell out of me.
So I went into the intensive care unit, and I talked with him. He couldn't talk. He had a deal in his mouth that he couldn't really talk, but his eyes told me everything. When he saw the neck brace on me, tears just ran down his cheeks. He felt so bad that I had been hurt. I could not believe it, that he could be so caring about everybody, and he was hurting so bad. But I hugged him at that time, and I kissed him on the side of his forehead, and I told him that I loved him. You know, I've always been the kind of person that kind of looked out for someone else, too. But this was so above and beyond anything you can imagine. Goodness, what could have gone through his head when we were going down, and he knew what was going to happen, and he was just trying to make sure that I got out of this okay. You know, he was going to take the whole brunt of it. I mean, for me, I mean, little old me. Ever since this happened, there has not been one day that I have not thought about him.
David and Shirley's story comes to us from the amazing radio series, Kind World, produced by WBUR in Boston. It's a special project sharing stories of kindness and the profound effect one act can have on our lives. That piece is produced by Lisa Tobin and Michael May. To find out more about Kind World, go to WBUR.org. We'll also have a link at snapjudgment.org. You've almost reached the end of the line, but not to fear. Subscribe to the Snap Judgment Podcast for hours of Snap storytelling available for you right now. Made with love at snapjudgment.org. Facebook, Twitter. Snap is produced by myself and the team that always pushes things too far. Please say hello to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti Miller, Nancy Lopez, Joe Rosenberg, Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Renzo Gorio, Davey Kim, Leon Morimoto, Anna Adlerstein, Eliza Smith, Aurora Soria, Jasmine Aguilera, and Will Urbina. Do you ever make fun of that
goofball. Wearing a cummerbund to the office meeting. But be sure you weren't talking about the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Much love to the CPB. PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. WBEZ in Chicago, the place of WBEZ when you're in Chicago. Now, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could put an apple on your head. I could walk 40 paces away and agree to split half the winnings if my aim proves true. Never mind that this is the end of the line episode. Even as I pull back the arrow on my bow, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.